As we turn now to Genesis chapter 28, we pick up the story of Jacob and Esau, especially of Jacob. Jacob and Esau have been central to the narrative in the previous chapters. We have found that Jacob obtained the birthright at some point in time, which is not specifically designated, early in the lives of these men, but apparently before they were 40 years old. Esau sold Jacob his birthright and went off and apparently forgot about the whole thing. However, at a later date, when Isaac, their father, wished to confer the patriarch blessing to the oldest son, who was Esau, Esau either had forgotten or did not prefer to remember that he had sold his right to this blessing. Fair and square, Jacob owned it. But Esau didn't mention that to his father. His father probably knew it too, really, because years had passed in the interim. And in all likelihood, it had been discussed in the family, since they all lived together, and that's an important transaction. But neither Isaac nor Esau cared to honor that sale of the birthright that had taken place years earlier. And so Isaac connived to give the blessing to Esau, or at least part of it. And Jacob, of course, deceived his father, came in impersonating his brother, and received the blessing that Isaac intended for Esau. When this ruse had been discovered by Esau, Esau was furious, determined that as soon as Isaac would die, which he would not be too far off, that he would kill Jacob. Rebekah heard about this, and she favored Jacob, just as Isaac favored Esau. And so Rebekah, in order to save Jacob's life from the wrath of his brother, and thinking that Esau's wrath would cool down in a while, and she was right, she knew her son well, his wrath did cool down, as it turns out, but she knew it would take a while for Esau to really come to grips with this and not be murderously angry toward his brother anymore. And so she advised Jacob that he should go and stay with her brother Laban in Paddan Aram. You'll remember him from the negotiations between Abraham's servant and the family of Rebekah. Bethuel, her father, and Laban, her brother, were the prime negotiators with the servant of Abraham over the marriage arrangements for Rebekah. Now, she hasn't seen her family for a very long time. She was barren for 20 years in her marriage, and then her sons that were finally born are 77 years old at this point. She hasn't had contact, in all likelihood, with her brother for 97 years. Now, how old is Laban now? After all, he was her older brother. And she's got to be nigh on to 107 at this point. We don't know how old Laban was. But remember, Abraham lived to be 175. Isaac himself lived to be in his 170s. I forget what the number was we gave. It's back here. I've written it down. Let's see. He lived to be, well, I didn't write down the exact number, 3528. Some of you may remember those kind of scriptural trivia. Let's see. Okay. Oh, yeah. Isaac lived to be 180. So, I mean, it's not unthinkable that Laban, as a very old man at this time, was still alive, though he would have to be in excess of 100 years old. She thought, that is, Rebekah thought, that Jacob could go for a little while and just kind of cool his heels there while Esau cooled his tool. And then he could come back and be rejoined to his mother. And this didn't happen. Actually, as it turned out, Jacob did go to Laban's, but he did not return for 20 years. And by the time he did, his mother was dead. So Rebekah, actually, because of her deception of her husband and because of this anger that she helped to arouse on Esau, lost the communion of her favorite son in her declining years of life, in her final years of life. She didn't plan to, but that's simply how the wages of sin materialized in her own case. Now, she comes to Isaac, the father, because for Jacob to leave the home and relocate to Paddan Aram would require Isaac's approval. He's the patriarch. He's the head of the family. And he'd have to think it was a good idea. Now, she doesn't come to Isaac with her true motivation. She doesn't say, you know, Esau's planning to kill Jacob, and so I think he should go to a safe place. She apparently doesn't think that would move Isaac. Isaac might think, that's not a bad idea, let Esau kill him. You know, I'm a little mad at him myself for deceiving me, you know. So rather than telling her true reasons to want Jacob out of town, or to go to town from out in the wilderness where they were, she comes up with another reason that she knows Isaac will resonate, it'll resonate with him. And that is that Esau had married Canaanite women whom both Rebekah and Isaac disliked. And she pointed out that Jacob was certainly of marriageable age. I mean, he was 77 years old. And Esau had been married since he was 40. So Jacob was almost twice the age that Esau had been when he got married, and yet he had married. So the assumption is, of course, Jacob's not going to wait forever to find a wife. And out here in Canaan, there's only Canaanite women. We certainly don't want him to do the same thing Esau did, marry Canaanites. So why don't we send him back home as your father Abraham sent a servant to get you a wife back in the family homeland. And why don't we do the same and get Jacob a wife there? So rather than disclosing to Isaac the fact that Esau was really planning to kill Jacob and that Jacob had to flee for safety, she used something that Isaac would feel positively agreeable with. And so Isaac calls for Jacob and makes it sound like it's his idea to send him off. And it says in chapter 28, Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother." Now, notice there's a blessing here. It's said in poetic form, and it is sort of a patriarchal blessing of sorts here in verses 3 and 4. May God Almighty, El Shaddai, bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may be an assembly of peoples and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you, that you may inherit the land in which you are a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. Now, one thing that's interesting here is that he now explicitly confers the whole Abrahamic blessing on Jacob. Earlier in chapter 27, when he blessed Jacob, thinking it was Esau, in chapter 27, verses 27 through 29, he conferred on him blessings, not distinctly the Abrahamic blessings. He conferred on, as he thought, Esau, though it was really Jacob, blessings of prosperity and blessings of superiority over his brothers. These are the same kinds of blessings that a friend in any family might receive. Had nothing to do with the Abrahamic covenant. And it seems rather clear that Isaac was, he knew that whether he liked her or not, he was going to have to confer the Abrahamic blessings on Jacob, not on Esau. But he nonetheless wanted to give Esau more than he had coming. He wanted to give Esau at least the material blessings of the birthright. And that's why when he thought he was blessing Esau, he conferred material but not spiritual blessings upon him. Later on, however, after he realizes that God has overruled his plan and that Jacob has gotten the material birthright as well, he now, without any reservation apparently, confers the Abrahamic birthright. The reference in verses 3 and 4 to his seed and to the land are clearly Abrahamic aspects of the birthright. And, of course, he specifically says in verse 4, to give you the blessing of Abraham. So Isaac has had to resign himself to, and he might have even earlier resigned himself to the fact that Jacob is the one who will have the Abrahamic blessings, though Isaac had hoped to give something to Esau, though that didn't ever happen in the sovereignty of God. God gave it to Jacob. God sovereignly working through the sins of Jacob and Rebekah. So Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take himself a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan," and that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. Also, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac, that is, his own wives, were not pleasing to his parents. Apparently, up to this point, Esau, it never crossed his mind that his parents didn't like his wives. If so, then he was very dense, because it's awfully hard for a person not to recognize that his parents don't love his spouse. I mean, and certainly the spouses would be aware of this. It's easy for any married person to tell whether your in-laws like you or not. And the fact that they did not like these women could hardly have escaped the notice of the women themselves. And if the women knew it, then Esau must have been informed of it. I can't imagine a wife hated by her husband's parents not complaining of this to her husband. And so Esau is kind of dense about this, it would seem. But he now realizes that this is serious, that his parents are absolutely adamant that Jacob should not marry women of Canaan. And Esau has not, he's not in the most favorable light right now in the family, so he's hoping to do something to maybe win his parents' approval more, it would appear. So Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife in addition to the wives he had. So he took a third wife, thinking that should make things better. His parents didn't like the Canaanite wives, so he married one that was a little closer related. Actually, a lot closer related, since the Canaanites were in no sense related to the family. Ishmael, at least, was an uncle of Esau's, and he was, of course, half-brother of Isaac himself. However, it's not likely, we're not told, but it's not likely that this marriage pleased Isaac and Rebekah anymore. I mean, to add additional wives doesn't change the fact that he still had two wives that they didn't like, and there's not really much reason to believe that they'd be all that pleased with the family of Ishmael either. So we're not told of any approval or disapproval of this marriage, only of Esau's desperate attempt to regain a certain amount of favor in the family. Verse 10, now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran, or Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. It was more than a day's journey where he was going, of course, probably several weeks. And he took one of the stones that lay of that place to put at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder. Now, the word ladder is how we usually think of it. We think of Jacob's ladder. Some scholars say that the Hebrew word should better be understood as like a staircase. Maybe not what we usually think of as a ladder, but in any case, an ascending set of steps was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord your God, the God of Abraham, your father, not your God, because he's not yet Jacob's God. I am the Lord, Jehovah, God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. So he's saying, Jacob, I'm not your God at this point, but I was your father's and your grandfather's God. I'd like to become acquainted with you. Jacob has never had contact with God before this. Now, God had appeared both to Abraham and to Isaac. But as far as we know, prior to this, he had never appeared to Jacob. Jacob's 77 years old. And he's never really had an encounter with God. He's been raised in a godly home of sorts. He's been raised with parents and grandparents who had known God. And he had religious training. He knew the name of Jehovah. He no doubt had participated in the family altar and so forth when they'd offered sacrifices to Jehovah. But with him, it was just a matter of going along with the family religion. It was not a case of him actually knowing or embracing or owning a relationship with God himself, as is very clear, not only from the way God speaks of himself here, but the way that Jacob also speaks of God in the following scriptures. And Jacob is sort of, the type of person who's raised in a Christian home, for the most part embraces as factual the beliefs of his parents, has no problem believing there is such a God as that. Many people raised in a Christian home have no problem believing that Jesus was the Son of God, that he died for sins, rose again, and so forth. But many people with such knowledge have that knowledge only, as Tozer says, by hearsay. It's only secondhand knowledge. It's not really anything that they could attest or testify to, because they don't know God. They only know about God. And, of course, no matter how strict or orthodox the upbringing of a child in a Christian home may be, that child is no Christian until that child has had his own encounter with God, until that child has personally repented and believed the gospel and come to know God, and the Holy Spirit has come to dwell inside of him. Religious training in a religious environment may be a tremendous advantage to a person after they've converted. That is to say that a person who's converted, having had a religious upbringing prior, may be miles ahead of somebody who is converted out of a very non-religious background, possibly. But But a religious background in itself prior to conversion is not necessarily an advantage. It can confer on a person a false sense of salvation, a sense that they know more than they really do. Since they know everything about religion, they may assume that that is their religion. They may assume that that what they know is all there is to know, and that they are Christians in the same sense that anyone is a Christian. And until they actually have a personal encounter with God, it is not so. Abraham and Isaac had both had personal visits from God and revelations, encounters with God. Jacob had not. This is his first acquaintance with God. And he makes some minor commitment here, but he does not commit himself to be a follower of God all the days of his life at this point. We'll see that commitment in his life. So God says, I am Jehovah, the God of Abraham, your father, the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, the north and the south, and in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely Jehovah is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. When a person who is raised, as I say, in a Christian home, finally meets God, they wake up from this revelation. They wake up from their slumber and say, wow, God is really real. God really is here, and I didn't know it. I mean, I knew about it, but I didn't know him. And I'm literally in the house of God. You know, a lot of people go to church or are in a church environment, a Christian home or whatever, which is truly a microcosm of the church, the body of Christ. And they know they're in a religious home, but they don't know they're in the house of God. They're in a house, they're in an environment, they're in a community, but they don't realize the presence of God in it until they have an encounter with God. And it stunned him when he realized this. Actually, all that God said to him was a repeat of what he'd said to Abraham and to Isaac previously. He's basically just catching up with Jacob, the next generation, saying, well, I told Abraham this, and I told Isaac this, and now I'll tell you this. I'm going to give this land to your descendants. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to travel with you. I'm going to keep you safe. I'm on your side. I've chosen you for a special purpose. And Jacob is definitely impressed. He's shaken. But he has not made a commitment. This is really interesting because in the study of Jacob's life, we can see another kind, a prototype of another kind of life besides that of Abraham. With Abraham, we find a man who very early on in the story made a full commitment to God. His initial response to God was only partial. He left Ur of the Chaldees but didn't go all the way to Canaan. He only went to Haran. But when his father died, he went all the way. And after that, we find him with some lapses of faith, nonetheless living out the life of a man who is committed to Jehovah, a man who in his own mind, there's no question, but Jehovah is his God, and that he has forsaken the idols of his family in order to embrace God. Now, Jacob's in the opposite situation. He doesn't come from an idolatrous family, and yet he himself has not known God. But even his first encounter with God is not necessarily a conversion, as we shall see. He is not converted to become a disciple or a follower of God at this point. It's an initial awareness that God is more real than he has realized, that God is more present than he's realized. He's heard about God all his life, but now he knows God's presence more certainly. There are many people who, prior to becoming actual Christians, prior to committing themselves, have startling encounters where the presence of God is known to them, a dramatic deliverance from a situation or an answer to a desperate prayer, or just a wave of awareness that sweeps over them because God moves upon them. Alerts them, gives them the creeps even, gives them goosebumps to realize, wow, there is a God. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they want to follow him or that they're ready to do so. This is the case with Jacob at this point. Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put at his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, which means house of God, because as he said earlier, this is the house of God, the gate of heaven. But the name of that city had previously been called Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. In other words, I'll wait until then. God has made certain promises. If God keeps his promises, if God does all the things I want him to do for me, then I'll make this decision. He'll be my God. Until then, he's my father's God and my grandfather's God. But he'll be my God after I see what he can do for me. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house. Isn't that generous of him? You know, give God a good deal that he can't refuse here. You know, God, you do all these things for me. Feed me, clothe me, keep me safe, deliver me from all my enemies, bring me back where I want to be at the right time when I want to be there. Then, God, I'll reward you by letting you be my God. I'll let you have this stone for your house. And of all that you give me, I'll surely give a tenth or a tithe. The word tithe means tenth. He'll give 10% to God. Okay, let's talk about this chapter a little bit. I've passed over some things without comment that I want to go back to. In the dream, the principal thing of importance, of course, that Jacob encountered was God himself. But there was a very dynamic image that caught his attention even prior to the image of God himself. And that was a ladder or a staircase connecting earth to heaven. There were angels ascending and descending on this staircase. What does that mean? Well, it's hard to know how Jacob understood it. We realize from New Testament revelation and even later Old Testament revelation that the angels of God come down to be ministering spirits to those who are the heirs of salvation. So it says in Hebrews 1:14 that God sends his blessings to his people through the angels. They come and minister. We also know that angels carry things back to heaven, like the souls of dead righteous people. We read that in the story of Lazarus and the rich man, how that the angels bore Lazarus when he died to the presence of Abraham, to Abraham's bosom. And we can assume, no doubt, that we who go to heaven when we die are born there by angels as well. It's also very possible that we would understand that our prayers are carried to heaven by the angels. The reason I say so is because in a symbolic vision in Revelation chapter 8, the inhabitants of heaven, I don't call them angels because they are called elders there, but they offer up to God the prayers of the saints in the form of incense. And it is as if the prayers of the saints on earth are being offered to God as incense by heavenly people, by people in heaven. We don't know who these elders are. No one knows for sure. But the point would be that in the imagery, it's as if perhaps God's messengers from heaven carry the prayers of God's people up, and they then come back down and bring the blessings from God. That God's angels simply are his messengers and his servants who minister to the saints. And they ascend and descend between, they're in continual commerce between heaven and earth. Now, what's interesting here is that he didn't just see angels flying back and forth. We've never, actually nowhere in the Bible does it tell us that angels have wings. That tradition comes from the assumption that they must certainly fly if they go between heaven and earth. But we don't have any indication in Scripture that angels have wings, and nor does that matter at all in any theological way. But we don't see the angels in this dream flying. We see them on a staircase. They're on a path that is in the vision, no doubt looks like a physical path, something they climb on and climb down. It is a passageway between heaven and earth. And it is the path of God's blessing to his people. It is the place where God's realm actually sets foot on man's realm of earth, and through which the prayers of God's people are carried up and the blessings of God are carried down. Now, I'm reading between the lines here. You don't have to accept this interpretation, but that is that's my take on what is meant in this dream. Now, if you will turn to John chapter 1, we have the only New Testament reference to Jacob's ladder. And in this place, I think we actually have the New Testament, and this is Jesus himself speaking, the New Testament teaching about what Jacob's ladder really represented. If you look at John chapter 1, verse Verse 47 and following, John 1, 47 and following, says, Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom is no guile. Nathanael said to him, How do you know me? Jesus answered and said to him, Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus answered and said to him, Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these. And he said to him, Most assuredly I say to you, hereafter, you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Now that expression, the angels of God ascending and descending, is an exact quote from Genesis 8:12. It says at the end of Genesis 28:12, and there the angels of God were ascending and descending. This expression is found only in these two places. It seems clear that Jesus is deliberately quoting that line from Genesis 28:12. It's verbatim. The difference in his statement and that in Genesis is that in Genesis the angels of God are ascending and descending on a ladder, a way between heaven and earth, an access route that actually sets foot on earth but provides access to God's throne. And Jesus sticks himself in that role of the ladder. He says, You will see the angels of God ascending and descending on, not Jacob's ladder, but on me, on the Son of Man. What he is saying is that what Jacob's ladder represented is really me. The blessings of God do come down to God's people through me. The prayers of God, of God's people, are carried up to God in my name, through me. No man cometh unto the Father but by me, he said, of course, in another place in the same book, John 14:6. Jesus is saying that Jacob's ladder and the access between heaven and earth, the point at which God's realm touches down and sets foot on man's realm, the avenue of blessing where the angels of God who minister to God's elect come down with their blessings and go up carrying the requests and so forth, the interface between heaven and earth, really, which Jacob saw, is representative of Jesus himself, the Messiah. This was a messianic dream, though Jacob, of course, didn't understand that. It took Jesus' own comments to clarify that. Now, of course, whether Nathanael ever had an actual vision where he saw something like Jacob had an actual dream and he saw this. I mean, Jesus said to Nathanael, you will see. After this, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. It's possible that Nathanael actually had a dream or a vision and saw with his eyes or with the eyes of his spirit these very things. But it's also possible that Jesus is speaking figuratively. Not that Nathanael would have an actual vision, but that he would eventually be enlightened to perceive that that's who Jesus is. He has only understood Jesus to be the Son of God and the King of Israel. That's pretty insightful. But he has not yet understood that he is, like Jacob's ladder, the only way to connect heaven and earth, the only way to get there from here. And otherwise you can't get there from here. And so this is Jesus' application of Jacob's dream. Jacob actually saw an image that represented Jesus. Now, about Jacob's promise that he made to God. He said, okay, God, you do all the things you said you'd do for me. Feed me, clothe me, protect me, get me safe where I want to go when I want to go there. Do everything for me, and I'll do something for you. We'll have a two-way agreement here. You can be my God then. Do you a big favor. And you can have this stone for your house, and I'll give you 10% of my income. It's amazing how many people think they're doing God a favor when they give God 10%. And the reason they think that is because they're always told by the pastors that they should give 10% to the local church. And most people obviously don't. Even though it is the official doctrine of many denominations that 10% of your income belongs to your local church where you attend and where you're a member. It's a doctrine not found in Scripture, by the way, but it is nonetheless the official doctrine of most denominations. We know that though that is official, yet most members don't do it. It has been calculated that approximately 3% of the income of church members actually is given to churches. Not 10%. Less than a third. And since tithing is actually relatively rare, when you finally meet someone who does tithe, pastors, you know, think, wow, this, we have a tithing member here. You know, someone who really gives 10%. And it'd be possible for someone to say, yeah, I do kind of stand out in this uncommitted crowd. I give fully 10% of my income. And it's amazing how some people think that that is the epitome of commitment. The epitome of self-sacrifice to God, that 10% is given. Jacob talks as if that is the case. Now, Jacob was not the first to pay tithes, to pay 10%. His grandfather, Abraham, had done this, at least on one occasion. We don't know of any other prior occasions or since, but when Abraham met Melchizedek in the 14th chapter of Genesis, we're told in chapter 14 that he gave Melchizedek a tithe of all. That's Genesis 14 and verse 20. Abraham's tithing to Melchizedek is the first known instance in Scripture of a man of God giving to the priest a tenth of his increase. Jacob's promise to do the same is the second known case in Scripture, and you never read of it again until the law comes. In the days of Moses, actually giving one-tenth was a prescribed amount that all Jewish people were to give to the temple for the support of the Levites. As I said a moment ago, many churches today believe that giving 10% of your income is prescribed as normative and obligatory for Christians as well in the New Testament. This, however, cannot be established from any scripture. It is clear that in the law of Moses, the purpose for giving 10% was for the support of the Levites, who were approximately 10% of the population. And it's quite obvious that if, 90% of the population, or maybe even closer to 100% of the population, give 10% of their income to a group that is roughly 10% of the population, then that 10% is going to have an income that's about average of what everyone else has. And that was God's way of supporting a full-time Levitical class, of whom came the priests. Now, not all the Levites were priests, but some were. And the Levites would take the money that was given to them, that tithe of all the other tribes was given to the Levites, and they would take a tithe of that, 10%, and give that to the priests. And so this is how God supported the temple, and prior to that, the tabernacle worship. All these full-time workers had to be supported, and so they were supported by a tenth of the national produce. Now, in the church today, there is no obvious reason why the number 10% would be a sensible or helpful or meaningful amount to give. It is simply a matter of Christians perpetuating the Old Testament norm that we have churches saying you should give 10% to God, because you certainly find in the Old Testament many exhortations for people to give their tithes to God. And in Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, God complains because his people have robbed him by withholding their tithes from him. And these statements have been the whole basis for a church teaching that, you know, Christians ought to give 10% to their church. But really, there is no statement in the New Testament that suggests that Christians have any obligation to surrender 10% of their income to any institution. And that's what a local church is, an institution. Bless you, brother. So the only way we would know that New Testament believers were required to pay a tithe is either because the Old Testament teaching just carries over unchanged into the New Covenant, which is an assumption that many have, or because there's some obvious reason why 10% of Christians' money should go to the local church. Now, there was an obvious reason why 10% of the Jews' money should go to the temple maintenance, because they needed it. There's about a tenth of the population to be supported. And so they needed that, approximately that amount. That made sense. But I don't know any local church that has one full-time minister for every 10 wage earners in the church. That'd be tremendous, really. I mean, if a church had 200 families and 20 full-time ministers on salary or whatever, or living off the tithes of these people, that would make 10% a sensible amount. It would make it a reasonable amount, and it would agree with the whole reason that God made that amount required of the Jews. However, of course, even churches that require their members to pay 10% to the local church usually don't have, probably don't have one full-time worker, one full-time salaried minister, even per 50 families in many cases. I mean, some do, but it's not uncommon for a church to have, let's say, 100 families or more, and only two full-time ministers who are supported. What do you do with, and yet all these people are supposed to tithe? What do you do with all the surplus? The minister just get rich? No. The surplus goes to other projects that they find. Missions, that's a good one. Relief to the poor, that's good. Building big buildings and gymnasiums and parking lots, well, I don't know if that's good or not. The thing is, you got to find something to do with all that money if people are tithing or even close to it. You don't have enough full-time ministers to absorb that, so you got to find things to do with the money. Some of them good, maybe some of them not so good. But the point is, it's 10% becomes artificial percentage in the church. There's no obvious reason why the amount that the church should receive is 10% as opposed to 5%, 20%, 50%, 3%. I mean, what's the magic about the number 10% that this should be imposed upon Christians? Well, obviously, the need for a literal 10% in the church is not the same as the need for a literal 10% in the Old Testament cultus, where approximately 10% of the population needed to be supported as full-time workers in the ministry. So the assumption that tithing should be done by Christians comes from the other possibility. Not so much that there's an obvious need for 10%, but that it's assumed that the Old Testament teaching just carries over into the New Testament without change. But that's not at all obvious. The New Testament never says that believers should tithe. The only mention of tithing in the entire New Testament is where Jesus says to the scribes and Pharisees that they had been meticulous in paying their tithes of mint, anise, and cumin, and had neglected the weightier matters of the law. And he said, this you ought to have done and not leave the other undone. That is, he said, you were right to pay your tithes, but you should have also done the weightier matters, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Now, in saying that the Pharisees had been right to pay their tithes, he was not teaching his disciples that they from now on need to tithe. He was simply saying the Jews living under the Jewish system had paid their tithes, and, well, they should have. They were required to. But that's not the same thing as teaching that tithing is a Christian obligation. It's simply an affirmation that the Pharisees did what they were required to do under their religious system. Now, many who do not believe that Christians are required to tithe will say, we're not under the law. Tithing is part of the law. And we're not under the law anymore, the parts that are moral in nature, and the parts that Jesus reiterated, and therefore we don't have to tithe. But those who say we do still have to tithe will say, wait a minute, tithing was practiced before the law. Tithing wasn't, you know, initially just part of the law. It was practiced by Abraham and by Jacob, long before Moses ever gave the law. Therefore, tithing predates the law. And it is not there. It does not rise and fall with the law. It may be that the law is passed, but tithing was a practice instituted before the law. And therefore, we cannot assume that it has passed away simply because the law has passed away. Well, that may be fair, but it is not consistent, because if it is true that anything that was practiced by godly men before the law must necessarily still be binding after the law, then we would have to still circumcise, because circumcision was practiced before the law also. So as animal sacrifices were observed before the law was given as well. But we don't think that either circumcision or animal sacrifices are a continuing obligation to Christians just because they were practiced by godly people before the law came. The fact is, we don't know that tithing was practiced per se before the law. We only have instances of two individuals without any command from God to do so, on one occasion each, giving 10% to God. Actually, Jacob, we don't read of him doing it. We only read of him promising it. But Abraham, on one known occasion, gave 10% of a particular spoils of a particular battle to God's priest who showed up. We have no teaching of Scripture that Abraham practiced tithing on a regular basis, or that Isaac ever did it, or that Jacob regularly did it. They might have, but they might not have. We simply don't have the teaching of Scripture that tithing was a practice. Now, lest you think that I'm against people giving their money to the church, far from it. When I say tithing, I'm speaking about the specific obligation to take a tenth and give it to the religious institution. I don't have any objection to people giving a tenth or 20% or 30 or 50 or 90% to the church, if the church needs it. All I would say is that in the New Testament we have no command, no obligation to tithe is ever stated in the New Testament. And there is another obligation, and that is to surrender all. Jesus said, unless a man forsakes all that he has, he cannot be my disciple. That everything that a Christian owns is surrendered to God. And that whatever he retains in his actual possession is God's property, and the Christian is the steward of it. You see, that's different than saying God owns one-tenth and I own the other 90%, as the old Jews could say. But the Christian can say, I don't own any of it. God owns all of it. And he can take any part of it he wants. He can require me to give 90% or 50% or 10% or 5% or whatever he wants. It's up to him. It's all his. And even the part I'm not giving to the church is his. And I have to do with it what I believe God wants done with his money. It's not that I discharge my entire obligation to God by giving him a check for 10% and then I can go and do my own selfish thing with the other 90. Every penny I have belongs to God if I'm a disciple of Jesus Christ. And that means the part I give to the church, the part I give to missions, the part I give to the beggar, the part I give to my children for Christmas, the part I spend on my housing and food and transportation, all that is God's. And I need to be conscientious in the administration of what belongs to God, because I'm a steward. And I have no reason to doubt that God wants some of this money to be spent on housing and clothing and food and other important things. But the fact that I spend it on that doesn't mean it's not God's money. It just means that I'm doing with it what I believe God would have me do with it. It's his, and I'm stewarding it according to my conscience before God. He might well tell you to give 10% to your local church, but he didn't say so in the Scripture. And that's fine. You may feel convicted to give 10%. I, for a long time, was convicted to give 20% to ministries, but none to a local church. The local church already was wasting the money they had, and I didn't feel it was good stewardship to give them any more to waste. There was a period of my life, and it was not too long ago, that I was taking 10% off the top and giving it to missions through missions organizations, and taking another 10% off the top and giving it to the poor. And I did that largely because I teach very plainly I don't believe that tithing is an obligation. And I wanted no one to be able to say, well, he just teaches that because he doesn't want to give 10%. So I said, well, okay, I'll give 20% and I'll still teach that tithing is not an obligation. I did that for years. Eventually I decided that I was just trying to prove something, and that was a little legalistic on my part. So I don't just do that off the top. Did that for a couple of years. By the way, I prospered very well during those years, more than any other previous time of my life. But anyway, what I'm saying is the fact that Jacob said that he would give God 10% does not mean that this was an established practice of all godly people back then. We don't know that to be the case. Actually, it's not a very generous offer. God's going to make him rich, and he's going to give a tenth. What's he going to do with the rest? Well, indulge, I guess. If there was a priesthood to support, if there was a temple cultus to maintain, and it would require 10%, that'd be a sensible thing to offer God. Jacob should be more generous with God than that, but he doesn't even know God yet. He knows about God, he's had an encounter with God, but he's made no surrender to God. He doesn't even say, you are my God. He says, you will be my God if you bring me safely home again. Well, that didn't happen until 20 years later. And it took Jacob 20 years to really own God as his own, as we shall see as the story progresses. Chapter 29, so Jacob went on his journey to the land of the people of the east. That'd be just east of Palestine in Syria, where Paddan Aram is. And he looked and he saw a well in the field, and behold, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks. A large stone was on the well's mouth. Now all the flocks would be gathered there, and they would roll the stone from the well's mouth, water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place on the well's mouth. Apparently, because water was at a premium, they didn't want the well to be uncovered, which would allow water to evaporate. They'd keep it capped with a big stone over the mouth of the well. And even they weren't allowed to just come and move the stone to get water for their sheep. Since all the sheep of the region were watered there, the custom was that all the shepherds had to bring their sheep there and wait for all the others to get there. And when they were all there, they would then remove the stone and they would water all the sheep at once and put the stone back on. This would mean that the well altogether would spend much less time uncovered than covered, or than otherwise. If they If every shepherd moved the stone to water his own sheep individually, then the sum total of minutes per day that the allowing a certain amount of evaporation to take place would be a greater amount of time. So they just decided, we'll consolidate this, we'll save water, we'll conserve this way. Everyone wait till all the sheep are there, then we'll water them all. There'll be no waste then, and the well won't, we won't lose any water necessarily. Now Jacob said to them, my brethren, where are you from? And they said, we are from Haran. Then he said to them, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, we know him. So he said to them, is he well? And they said, he is well. And look, his daughter Rachel is coming with the sheep. Then he said, look, it is still high day. It is not time for the cattle to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go feed them. But they said, we cannot until all the flocks are gathered together, and they have rolled the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep. Now, he obviously wanted to get them out of there so he could be alone with Rachel. He says, why are you waiting around? Just water sheep and get out there. You got a lot of daytime left. You're burning daylight. And they said, well, we got no choice. It's culturally required that we wait until everyone comes. Now, while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth. He's never stood on ceremony. He went ahead and broke the custom. And he watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Jacob saw Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. Well, we know Rachel as his future wife. She didn't know him from Adam at this point. For this old man to come up to this young virgin girl who's probably in her early teens, and to kiss her and weep and so forth, he's obviously full of emotion. And it's not merely a matter of an old, dirty old man lusting after a young chick. I mean, he's moved by the fact that this is his mother's niece. This is a relative. He didn't know any relatives until now. And this is the woman now that he has determined he wants to marry. She's also very beautiful, but that's another issue. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. Then it came to pass, when Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him. Which shows that kissing people, as when Jacob kissed Rachel, it was not a sensual kind of thing. People just greeted one another with a kiss, with a holy kiss, as later in the New Testament. Laban kissed Jacob, too. Very typical in that culture. And brought him to his house, and he told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him for a month. That is, he stayed with him initially for a month, just as a guest. However, it was clear that probably, since Rebekah said to Jacob, go away for a few days and come back when your brother's anger is assuaged. Well, a few days had now passed. In fact, a month. It's possible that he, you know, the general edge on Esau's anger may have cooled by now, and Jacob could have gone home. The few days has passed. However, he's not eager to leave. He's got his eyes on Rachel as a potential wife. So he stays around a month. And it doesn't look like he's ready to go home yet. He wants to stay longer. So Laban said to Jacob, because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what should your wages be? Now, should you serve me for nothing suggests that maybe Jacob was already doing some work. After all, Rachel was out with the sheep. Jacob found some way to... Jacob had some expertise in shepherding, too. He grew up in a shepherd home. Both Abraham and Isaac had been shepherds. And so... in 70 years raised in a home like that, though he spent most of his time in the kitchen cooking sheep, he couldn't have failed to learn something just in the conversations he overheard from the servants and from the family members and stuff. He knew a lot about sheep. And so he apparently went out with Rachel to help watch the sheep, and to protect her, you know, from wolves and things like that. And So Laban realized that he was gaining something from the labor, or at least from the presence of Jacob out there with the sheep. He says, hey, you know, I could pay you for this. I could hire you. Why should you serve me for nothing? What would you like to be paid? Now, Laban had two daughters, and the name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were, now this next word is hard to translate. Some translate weak. The New King James says delicate. And notice really exactly what is meant by her eye being weak or delicate. Apparently, this is mentioned in contrast with Rachel, who was said to be beautiful. So apparently, whatever it was about Leah's eyes, it would seem that perhaps this has to do with her appearance, the appearance of her eyes, where it was not as attractive as Rachel, because it says Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel's was beautiful in form and appearance. She had a beautiful appearance as well as a beautiful form. Now, of course, Americans have their own way of describing the beautiful form of a woman. The shape of a woman that's got beautiful form for us has very distinct stereotypes attached to it. In the Middle East, probably a beautiful form meant she weighed 300 pounds. Honestly, I mean, the taste in women has not always followed the American Twiggy-influenced tastes, you know. I mean, frankly, I mean, like most Americans, like most products of my culture, I don't consider 300 pounds to be the most attractive shape or size of a woman. But in many cultures, a woman was considered to be most attractive if she was very heavy. You know, we picture from all the Bible storybooks and movies and so forth that Rachel must have been looked like some kind of a movie actress today. But to say she was beautiful in form and appearance might have meant she was about the shape of the Goodyear blimp. It's hard to say, because that was not at all unattractive in those days. If anything, that might be seen as desirable. I am not saying that I know or claim to know what form Rachel was. All we know is that according to the tastes of the very appealing in that respect. Now, I wonder why it mentions Leah's eyes only. I wonder if it is because the women veiled themselves in such a way that nothing but the eyes were visible. And in those days when you couldn't see much of the body or the face or the hair, all of it being veiled, just the eyes looking out, a man would judge whether a woman was pretty or not by no other criteria than her eyes. And that would certainly be the case in some Muslim countries today. And there's no reason to doubt that it might have been the case in the same general region centuries ago. Yeah, but I don't know what it means that her eyes were weak. Maybe she wore Coke bottle glasses or something, and that sort of couldn't even see her eyes. Obviously not, but they didn't have glass in those days. But the point that is being made in verse 17 is that Rachel was pretty, attractive to Jacob, and Leah, for some reason or other, was not as attractive to him. He wasn't interested in her. He wanted to marry Rachel. Now, Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, "I will serve you, Laban, 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter." It was typical for a man, when he wanted to marry a girl, to give to the father some kind of a bride price, the price of a virgin. Jacob was traveling light. He didn't have any money with him. He came from a wealthy family, had a tremendous estate that he stood to inherit, but he didn't have any money on him. So he said, "I'll work off the bride price. I will work for 7 years. And instead of being paid, I will take my pay all at once at the end of that period of time in the form of your daughter Rachel to be my wife." And Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed but a few days to him because of the love that he had for her. And that 7 years passes between verse 19 and verse 21. And verse 21, it's all over. "Then Jacob, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in to her." And, of course, Jacob now was 84 years old. So he's got no time to lose. He's got to start a family. "And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. And Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah." Now, of course it was Leah in the morning. It was her the night before, too. But the reason it says in the morning, "behold, it was Leah," is because that's how soon Jacob discovered it. He didn't know that he had married and slept with Leah until morning light. Now, that might seem very strange that you would have a wedding and, as it were, a wedding night, and not know until the next day who it was that you married. And, of course, this suggests that there was obviously a lot of veiling of women at their weddings, and And apparently they, you know, they had their wedding night in a totally dark tent without any light. They didn't have access to light after the sun went down quite as readily as we do. And they might not have considered it as important as Americans would to see the person they're with. Very different culture. But it seems clear that this man, the culture was such that a man could marry a woman, and because of the way she was, as it were, veiled and hidden in her wedding clothing, and the fact that the wedding night was spent without enough light to even see who you're with, makes it possible that a man could marry someone and not know till the next morning who it was. It's an amazing thing, really. I mean, it just shows the cultural distance between them and us. This could not happen in our society. But the next morning, Jacob realized that he had been given the wrong woman. And he said to Laban, "What is this that you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me?" And Laban said, "It must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn." Now he tells him. I mean, this may have been a true custom, but how is it that Jacob worked for 7 years without hearing of it? Especially when he said, "I'll work 7 years and you give me Rachel." That would have been, it seems to me, the time for an honest father to say, "Oh, well, I don't mind you marrying Rachel, but you're going to have to marry Leah first, or she's going to have to get married to someone first, because I can't marry off my younger daughter before my older daughter." He just didn't mention that. Now, if Jacob would say, "Why didn't you tell me this in the first place?" Laban might be able to say, "Well, in 7 years' time, for all I knew, Leah would find a husband. So, I mean, I didn't feel like it was that pressing. But now that the time has come and Leah's still single, well, had to give her away first." Obviously, it's a lame excuse. It does not in any sense excuse Laban of lying, even if the custom was true. He could have been upfront about it and said, "Listen, you've labored for Rachel, and you've got her coming, but really, I can't really let Rachel be married before Leah. No one has come along to marry Leah, so you're going to have to marry them both. If you're going to take Rachel, you have to marry Leah too." Jacob probably would have agreed to it. Not because he loved Leah, but because that was the only way to get Rachel. We can see that the deception is not absolutely necessary, but and never is. There are times when telling the truth might be a little harder to get your way done than by deception, like if Rebecca had confronted Isaac rather than deceiving him. That would have been better and probably would have gotten the same job done, but confrontations are a little hard. It's easier just to connive than to confront with the truth and say, "We work this out in an honest way." Then Laban said, verse 27, Laban is still speaking, "Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you will serve me still another 7 years." And now this doesn't mean that Jacob had to work another 7 years and then he could have Rachel. It meant fulfill Leah's week. That is, have like a honeymoon week. You know, let Leah have you to herself for a week and then you can have Rachel also, but you'll owe me 7 more years of labor. It's not as if Jacob had to wait a total of 14 years to get the wife he wanted. He got her after 7 years, but he got her with a debt attached that he had to work another seven in order to take care of his obligation. So he did so, and he fulfilled Leah's week. They had a honeymoon for a week, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to wife also. And Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. So each of the daughters has a maid, Zilpah and Bilhah, and they become significant in the next chapter. Then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban still another 7 years. Now, what we read of in verses 31 through the next chapter happened during those 7 years. Okay, we're told by way of anticipation that in verse 30 that Jacob went ahead and fulfilled his obligation. He worked 7 years. But then we're told how he occupied himself and how his family grew during those 7 years that he was still working for Laban. Verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, literally in the Hebrew, the New King James changes that to unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Now, it's interesting because literally in the Hebrew it says Leah was hated. And yet she wasn't hated in the sense that the Bible frequently places this contrast. When one person is favored over another, It is said that one is loved and the other is hated. But in such usage, the word hated just means loved less than another one. When Jesus said no one can serve two masters, he'll have to love the one and hate the other. That's not true if we think of love and hate as absolute, polar opposites of emotion. But it is true if we understand it means that you must favor one over the other. One will be loved less than the other. You can't love them both equally. You have to have a commitment to one that transcends your commitment to the other, because they can't both demand your same time on different projects. You have to show favoritism if you have two masters. You can't be equally committed to both. Likewise, when God says, Jacob I have loved and Esau I have hated in Malachi, he just means that I have favored Jacob over Esau. This is a Hebraism. It's a figure of speech. And we see it even here, because in 31 it says Leo is hated. But in the previous verse it says Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. That's all. Being hated in this particular context is she was loved less than Rachel was. It should not be thought that Leah was found absolutely repugnant to Jacob. I mean, he had seven children by her ultimately, six sons and a daughter. And you just wouldn't have children by a woman if you found her absolutely repugnant. She was not favored. It was very clear that there was favoritism toward Rachel. And that grieved Leah, as anyone would imagine it would. She was actually the first wife, and she felt she had first dibs on her husband, and yet the second wife was favored by her husband, and that grieved her. So the Lord consoled her by giving her children, and not children to Rachel. Rachel was barren. So Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, Jehovah looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. Reuben means see a son in Hebrew. See a son. Check it out, Jacob. I've given you a son. Rachel hasn't. See? A son. For Jehovah has surely looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved or hated, he has therefore given me this son also. And she called his name Simeon. And Simeon means heard, because the Lord has heard. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons. Therefore his name was called Levi, which means attached. Verse 35, then she conceived again and bore a son and said, now I will praise Jehovah. Therefore she called his name Judah, which means praise. Then she stopped bearing. Now, what's interesting here is we learn something about Leah's state of mind. Leah, first of all, when her first three sons are born, she expresses hope that this may improve her relationship with her husband. Now my husband will love me, she says when the first son is born. The Lord heard that I was unloved, so the Lord gave me this son also with the second one. In other words, I hope that'll change the fact that I'm unloved. God has looked on me. He's helping me out to change the situation. When Levi was born, she says, now this time my husband will become attached to me. Each time she bore a new son, for the first three sons, she expressed some kind of hope that this would improve her husband's love for her. But by the time the fourth son is born, she realizes nothing is improving. And so she says, well, I'll just praise Jehovah. She is not seeing this as something that will necessarily improve her marriage. She's given up on that. And what we have to understand from reading the next chapter is while these four sons were being born in four successive years, there were other sons being born in the household, as we shall see in chapter 30. During the same 4 years that these four sons were born, Bilhah had two sons and Zilpah had sons also. Because there began to be, after Leah had her first son and Rachel didn't have any, there began this competition where Rachel gave her maid and then Leah gave her maid to Jacob. And this all happened in chapter 30. Much of this happened during these first 4 years, because altogether Jacob, by these women, had 11 sons in 7 years, as we shall see. Now, I want to point out also that Leah is mindful of Jehovah. In three of the four sons, she mentions Jehovah. When Reuben is born, she says, Jehovah has surely looked on my affliction. When Simeon was born, she says, Jehovah has heard that I'm unloved. And when Judah is born, she says, now I'm going to praise Jehovah. you will find that Rachel does not mention Jehovah. When her children are born, she names them things that have to do with her strife with her sister. You know, there is a good case to be made that God never intended Jacob to marry Rachel. It is true that eventually Joseph and Benjamin came from Rachel. But Jesus didn't come through them. Jesus came through Judah, and Judah was a child of Leah. Although Jacob wanted to marry Rachel, it would appear that in the sovereignty of God, quite apart from any of his own plans, God saw to it he was married to Leah. It was Jacob who insisted beyond that to be married to Rachel also. He could have, you know, what happened with him and Laban there is very similar to what happened to his own father by him. He deceived his father. His father wanted one thing and he wanted another, and he connived and he got what he wanted. His father, Isaac, when he realized that the blessing had been given to Jacob, when he really wanted to give to Esau, Isaac at least resigned himself to it. Okay, God beat me on this one. You know, I wanted to give it to Esau, but God went around my back and gave it to Jacob, the one that God wanted to. And Isaac resigned himself to that. He didn't keep trying to find ways to give it to Esau after that. He realized, okay, God overruled me on this, and this is the will of God. Isaac resigned himself to it. But Jacob didn't know God and wasn't committed to God. And he could have said the same thing. I wanted Rachel, but in the providence of God, God overruled it. He gave me Leah. I guess that's what I'm going to have to settle for. This is the will of God. Instead, he says, nope, I'm going to have Rachel too. But God's blessing wasn't on that marriage with Rachel. He made her barren. Altogether, Jacob had 12 sons, 6 of them from Leah, and 2 each from 3 other women. Leah had the majority of the children, including the one through whom the Messiah came, who received the birthright. Furthermore, Leah ended up buried with the family at Machpelah. Jacob and Leah were buried there, as were Isaac and Rebekah and Abraham and Sarah. Rachel never got buried there. She died en route to somewhere, and she had to be buried outside Bethlehem, far from the family burial place. God never allowed Rachel to be brought into burial with Jacob. Rachel does not show signs of devotion to Jehovah. Leah does. Leah appears to be more godly than Rachel. In fact, the only thing that is ever said in Rachel's favor is that she's pretty. And that is not a very good reason for a godly man to choose a wife, for only because she's pretty. Now, I said the other day there's nothing wrong with physical attraction in marriage, but if that's all there is, if godliness is not a factor too, then it's a lousy choice. And we do find later on, and we find it right in the very next chapter, chapter 30 at the beginning, the strife between Rachel and Jacob. They have a stormy marriage. He married because of attraction, physical attraction. But the woman has no character. She's not godly. And it's a stormy, argumentative marriage. Leah, on the other hand, doesn't have that many arguments with Jacob, largely because he doesn't spend much time with her, maybe. But also, she's more pious. She is aware of Jehovah. She has embraced the religion of Jehovah. She worships Jehovah. We don't find that so of Rachel. Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, which would be only after the first of Leah's was born, as it turns out. In order to get 11 sons born in 7 years, you've got to have this that we're about to read of happening very early on in that period of time. Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel. And he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld you from the fruit of the womb?" Or withheld from you the fruit of the womb. So she said, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her." Same thing Sarah said to Abraham, "Go into my maid, and she will bear a child on my knees, that I may also have children by her." Same thing that Sarah did. Jacob should know that that didn't work well in Abraham's family, that suggestion. But he submits. Then she gave him Bilhah, her maid, as a wife, and Jacob went into her. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has judged my case." Notice how she doesn't say Jehovah. She says Elohim. That's a more generic name for God. It's not the name of Jehovah specifically. Any God is Elohim to the Middle Eastern people. It's a generic word for God. God has judged my case. She doesn't say, what she's saying is, God is getting back at my sister for me. It's a revengeful kind of a situation. And he has also heard my voice, son. Therefore, she called his name Dan, which means judging. And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a son. And Rachel said, with great wrestlings I've wrestled with my sister, and indeed I have prevailed. Again, no mention of Jehovah, just a mention of her strife with her sister and her hostility and competition and rivalry with her sister. And she called his name Naphtali, which means wrestling. Now, when Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, now that was after Judah was born, 4 years into the marriage, she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob as a wife. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, a troop comes. Apparently, by faith, she says this. Like, okay, we're going to have a lot of kids coming down the pike here. This is the first fruits of that. So she called his name Gad, which means a troop. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. And Leah said, I am happy, for the daughters will call me blessed. So she called his name Asher, which means happiness or happy. You know, like one of the seven dwarfs. Leah is happy, but she's not happy in her marriage. Her husband never did come around to favoring her, but God was clearly favoring her. And now she had six sons to her credit. She actually had two more by her own body later, but her maid's sons were also counted as hers. So she sees herself as really blessed with children. She may not have a happy marriage, but she's got a lot of kids, and she counts that as an alternative reason for being happy, alternative to having a happy marriage, apparently. Now, Reuben went in the days of the wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah, because he was her son. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son mandrakes. Now, mandrakes are a plant that were believed to have the powers to increase fertility and an aphrodisiac. So it was thought that if a person would eat mandrakes, it would increase their fertility. Maybe true. I mean, there are herbal things that can help to increase and herbal things that decrease fertility. And for all we know, they may be right. In any case, according to the folk herbal lore of the time, what Reuben found was something that could increase a woman's fertility. And Rachel, up to this point, had never had a child by her own body, only a couple by her maid. And Leah, too, though she had had four, had stopped bearing. That's why she had brought her maid into the picture. So both of these women were now not having babies at the moment. And so these mandrakes became an occasion for one of them, at least, to possibly increase their fertility. And Rachel said, give me some of your son's mandrakes. And Leah said to her, is it a small matter that you've taken away my husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. We can see who wears the pants in that family. Jacob will sleep with you tonight. I've determined it. You know, I mean, it's obviously Rachel had the say. When Jacob came into her tent, she'd say, not tonight. I've made a deal. You sleep with Leah tonight. Wonder who the head of that house was. Anyway, it was agreed upon. And Leah gave Rachel the mandrakes. Now, when Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come into me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night, and although she didn't use the mandrakes herself, God opened her womb, and God listened to Leah, and she conceived. This would be her fifth son. And Leah said, God has given me my hire, because I have given my maid to my husband. So she called his name Issachar, which means hire. Then Leah conceived again, apparently a year later probably, and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. So she called his name Zebulun, which means dwelling. Afterwards she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. We don't know whether any other daughters were born besides Dinah. She's the only one mentioned. And she might be the only one that was ever born, but she is mentioned certainly here because she becomes significant in a later story. There may have been other daughters who are never mentioned simply because there are no stories about them worth telling. Now, 2 years in a row, apparently, Leah had a couple more children. But during that time, Rachel had her first one too. In verse 22, it says, God remembered Rachel. It doesn't say the mandrakes did it that she got, but God opened her womb. God listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son, and she said, God, again she doesn't say Jehovah, just the generic, for God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph, which means adding. For she said, the Lord, now she says Jehovah, Jehovah shall add to me another son. She's starting to pick up the language of the family religion now, and calling God by the proper name. We see now 11 sons born. And it says in verse 25, it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go to my own place, to my own country. Now, this means that he had finished his obligation. He'd worked 7 years. Now, he'd actually worked 14, but he didn't get his wives until after the first seven. So he had now been married for 7 years. But Joseph has already been born, and that's the 11th son. So 11 sons have been born in 7 years. How did this happen? Well, of course, it might not be hard to imagine how a man impregnated simultaneously could have 11 sons in 7 years, but it's less clear how the order of events that we've just read of could have happened in 7 years. Because I think we'd have to assume that Leah's first four children were born in the first 4 years. And during that same time, Bilhah's two children were born. Remember, but that happened because Rachel noticed that she wasn't bearing. Apparently, to get pregnant was not all that hard in those days, unless there was something wrong, unless God was withholding. And within the first year, Leah got pregnant, but Rachel didn't. And that was evidence enough that there was something wrong, and so Rachel didn't waste any time, and she got Bilhah in on the action. And so probably in the second and third year of the marriage, Bilhah had sons. But Leah also had sons those same years, her second and third sons. But when after her fourth son was born, after the fourth year, Leah stopped bearing. And so she got her maid into the action. And she must have noticed immediately that she stopped bearing. You know, there are some women who get pregnant as soon as they stop nursing, or I've known women to get pregnant within 2 weeks after they had a child. It's not very common. But Leah was apparently exceedingly fruitful, and, you know, only a few months could possibly have gone by in order to fit in this time frame. She realized she stopped getting pregnant. She had a baby, and she didn't get pregnant in the next few months. She realized something wasn't going right, so she got Zilpah into the action. So that in the fifth and sixth years, Zilpah had her two children. But in the seventh year, I should say during the same years, after Zilpah got pregnant, Leah got pregnant again, in the sixth and seventh years also, as well as Zilpah. And those would have been her last two sons that were mentioned after the mandrakes had been found. And finally, in the seventh year, Rachel finally gets pregnant and has a son. It's hard. You got to cram them in there. But basically what it is where it says Rachel noticed she was barren and Leah noticed she had stopped bearing and so forth. This noticing must have been very immediate. I mean, it's not like they waited a few years and said, boy, I wonder why I'm not having any kids. It had to be a matter of months that they realized, hey, I'm not getting pregnant. And which suggests that that women were accustomed to getting pregnant rather quicker than that. And in any case, there's no impossibility in it. It's just remarkable that this series of events would all happen within that short period of time. But now that time has passed. And so he comes to Laban, his employer, and says, okay, I've fulfilled my obligation. Give me my wives. I want to go to my own place, my own country. He says, give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know that the service which I have done for you. And Laban said to him, please stay, if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. I'm not sure why the King James and the New King James use the word experience here. I've learned by experience. Because in the Hebrew it means by divination. Divination is like fortune telling. It's an occult practice. And apparently, we shall find later on that Jacob says, Laban, when I came to you, you had very little, and now you have a lot. Apparently, during the years that Jacob had been with Laban, Laban had progressed from a guy who was not particularly wealthy to an extremely wealthy man. And apparently, he wondered about that. I wonder why this is happening. And he must have consulted tea leaf reading or you know, gold dust on the top of a wine glass or something like that. One of these chicken entrail, you know, reading or something. Maybe he went to some fortune teller, or maybe he practiced it in his own home. We don't know. Got a Ouija board out or something. But by divination, he discovered that the reason that he was prospering was because Jacob was in his home. And so he was not eager to make a leave after he had fulfilled his obligations. He says, I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. Then Laban said, name me your wages and I'll give it. Jacob said to him, know how I served you and how your livestock has been with me. For what you had before I came was little, and it is now increased to a great amount. And the Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now, when shall I also provide for my own house? In other words, I've worked 14 years. I've got 11 kids, four wives, and I don't own anything. I've been increasing your estate, your livestock. I don't own anything. When am I going to provide an estate for my own family? So he said, Laban said, what shall I give you? And Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all the flock today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted sheep, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats. And these should be my wages. Now, ordinarily, these would be in the minority. The majority of the sheep were solid white, and the majority of the goats were solid black. So the color variations he mentions would have been the odd specimen, certainly not in any sense the majority of the flock. He would get the unusual sheep. And certainly it sounded like a modest proposal to Laban. And Jacob says, so my righteousness will answer for me in time to come when the subject of my wages comes before you. Everyone that is not speckled or spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs will be considered stolen if it is with me. Now he knew that Laban was not a man of integrity. And he knew that Laban didn't trust him either. Actually, Jacob wasn't all that much a man of integrity, judging from the way he treated his father. And so we had a couple of shucksters here who were, ready to get the most out of each other they could. And Jacob says, listen, there will no doubt be disputes among us as to which life are mine and which are yours. And you might even accuse me of having stolen some years, but here's the easy way to tell. All the livestock of a certain color will be mine. And all those of a certain color pattern will be yours. And that'll make it easy. No one can ever claim that I stole any of yours. You can just find out. If any of the sheep or the goats among my flocks are your color, then I've stolen them. Otherwise, you can't accuse me. And that's what he had in mind by this arrangement. And Laban said, oh, that it were according to your word. It sounded very modest, since only the very small minority of the animals were of the coloration pattern that would belong to Jacob. So he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had some white on it, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and he gave them to the hand of his sons. Then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. What's interesting is verse 35, it says, he removed. It sounds like Jacob, because Jacob said, let me pass through, let me get these sheep out. And so it says, he removed. We don't find out that he is Laban until verse 36. It's Laban who did this. Because even though he agreed to the terms of Jacob, he still didn't trust him. He wanted to give himself the advantage. What apparently Laban did was he took all of the ones that in the future, the offspring of these colors would be Jacob's. But apparently Laban took these actual specimens, the adult specimens of this color, and kept them for himself so that Jacob would have to start with a solid colored flock. And only, if he kept these speckled ones in there, for all he knew, Jacob might connive to have the rams that were speckled do all the breeding. And Jacob would get all the sheep and the goats. So that Laban, in order to keep Jacob from conniving and manipulating things, took the breeding stock of those colors and took them away and put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob so that Jacob couldn't doctor this thing up in such a way as to produce the livestock he otherwise owned. Yes?
Why, in verse 31, why does Jacob say, you shall not give me anything?
Yeah, you shall not give me anything. In other words, I'm not going to ask for anything that is yours. Let me continue to tend your sheep. However, if the sheep produce speckled or spotted or whatever, those will become mine. They never were Laban's. Laban owns the breeding stock, but any offspring, which would be rare, that were these unusual color patterns, Jacob said, I'll take those for mine. And those never would have been Laban's. They're born Jacob's. He's not going to take anything that was once Laban's and take it for himself. The sheep and goats that had not yet been born were nobody's because they didn't exist. And the ones of a certain color would belong from the beginning to Jacob and would never belong to Laban. So he wouldn't be taking anything from Laban that Laban had owned. That's what he's saying. The offspring of Laban's sheep, some of them would be Jacob's. when they were born because of their coloration, but he didn't want Laban to take some of his own things to Jacob. That's what he means. You should not give me anything. Now, Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar and of the almond and chestnut trees and peeled white strips in them and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled, he set before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs, where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Then Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the streaked and all the brown in the flock of Laban. But he put his own flocks by themselves, and he did not put them into Laban's flock. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in. So they were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man became exceedingly prosperous, and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Now, we only have a few minutes for me to comment on this, but I'm going to comment more on it at the beginning of the next session, because what we read in chapter 31 helps us to understand what's really going on in these last verses of chapter 30. It's easy to misunderstand what's going on in chapter 30, what Jacob's doing, because many people have the mistaken notion, and I think it is a mistaken notion, that Jacob believed in prenatal influence. That is to say, some people think that Jacob is peeling some of the bark off of these sticks to make streak appearances on them, so that when the livestock were breeding and looking at these streaked rods, it would influence the coloration of the offspring that were conceived, making them streaked. Now, some ancient peoples might have had such silly notions as that. We know certainly that that is not the case. It is much more a matter of genetics that determines the coloration of the offspring. But some Christians of the Bible, see, Jacob was superstitious. He thought he could increase the number of streaked animals by having them look, by having the breeding animals look at streaked sticks, and that the streaks on the sticks would somehow impact through their brain the color of the offspring that would come. And this is obviously superstitious and totally unscientific. And so Jacob is accused here of superstitiousness. Now, what's worse than this, the accusation doesn't fall on Jacob alone. After all, he might be superstitious, but it falls on the Bible itself, because the Bible insists that because of his procedures, more livestock accrued to him. More of the colors that belonged to him were born. And therefore, it sounds like the Bible is saying not only did Jacob have this superstitious idea, but the writer of the Bible thought it worked too. And that this then, the Bible is simply pre-scientific, is out of touch with the laws of genetics, that the writers did not understand what really makes sheep or goats be born of a certain color pattern as opposed to another, and the idea of prenatal influence through vision of the parent animals is somehow affirmed in this story. I would like to suggest a very alternate explanation of what Jacob was doing. I don't think that any of that scenario that I've just described is true to the passage. I don't think we have any suggestion of prenatal influence here. I believe that, in fact, Jacob, an astute cattle rancher from the days of his youth and from a family of generations of cattle ranchers, knew a great deal, not only of the folklore, but of the actual science of animal husbandry. And I think that what he did was quite sound by modern standards. And we need the information from chapter 31 to supplement this, because he goes on and explains more of what happened. And when we get all the information, it certainly looks like the Bible is not in error here. The Bible is, in fact, agreeable with what can be known about modern animal husbandry. But because we're out of time for this session, we'll have to wait till next session. We'll get into chapter 31. We'll get the additional information, and we'll be able to understand better what it is that Jacob was up to and why it worked. Okay? So we'll stop there and take a break at this point and come back to chapter 31.